start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 1047. And counsel will give us a summary of that as he works his way back to the podium.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1047 comes to us from the Rules Committee. This measure would give the local public safety coordinating councils, known as LPSCs, the authority to form multidisciplinary teams to review domestic violence fatalities and make recommendations to prevent such fatalities in the future. The bill does not require an area LPSC to form such a team. There is a dash one amendment in your packet. The amendment clarifies several aspects of the original bill. It clarifies that it is the LPSCs that act as the body that convene the review team. It clarifies that the team's role is not to investigate, but rather to review facts and make recommendations based on those factual reviews. It also clarifies the membership of the team. It deletes references to criminal defense attorney, city attorney, county council, who had been listed as original members of the team, and adds a domestic violence survivor to the team. And it also, with respect to the membership issue, provides that other members may be added to the team, but only with the unanimous consent of the rest of the team. It also amends the original bill by requiring a two-thirds vote rather than a unanimous vote, rather than a majority vote, which was in the original measure, for the team to actually release any recommendations. And then finally, the dash one adds some clarifying language with respect to the documents that are obtained by the team that would otherwise be subject to strict confidentiality, and it makes clear that those records would not be immune from the discovery statute solely because those documents were presented to a fatality review team. The original bill, I should note, adds that the public meetings statutes do not apply to the team's meetings.
Thank you. We're going to start with a panel of Hans Bernard, Sybil Hebb, and Judge Kosh. Is she here?
Yes.
Oh, Representative Thatcher is... Sorry, I missed you there. Would you like to come up as well?
Oh, sure.
We'll let you start here. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kim Thatcher. I'm representative for District 25. I heard the bill's twin over on the House side, House Bill 3011, while a member of the House Judiciary Committee. And one of the notes I took during testimony was, I love this bill. In my opinion, if there was ever an opportunity for the government to perform its constitutional duty in protecting the rights of life and liberty, it's in this bill to create the authority for a multidisciplinary review of records related to domestic violence fatalities for the express purpose of preventing future deaths is frankly a no-brainer. As I said during my committee meeting, I feel very strongly about this bill. I think that we as a legislature want to see government be more effective, and this is one way we can actually provide for a process that will save lives. This will allow us to identify the gaps in our response to domestic violence incidents and help us prevent these tragedies in the future. Without this review, I believe we could be inadvertently facilitating deaths because our process is inefficient and unable to respond appropriately. I heard during a committee meeting testimony from Terry Quinneros that this would honor the victim and ensure that her death was not in vain. And that's really struck me. And I second that thought and hope you will, too, by passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? Thank you. Senator Starr.
Yes, Representative. Does your testimony pertain to the Dashwood Amendments?
No, Senator. Chair Verdick, it does not pertain specifically. We did not have dash one amendments when I saw it, but from what I've heard, the dash one amendments do clarify to a good extent. Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Senator Starr. Next, we'll move to Hans Bernard, who will be representing Senator Kate Brown, who brought this bill to us. Hans, and you need to be on your way soon.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Hans Bernard. I'm legislative assistant to Senator Kate Brown. Senate Bill 1047 is a piece of legislation which I think fills a crucial link in our response to domestic violence in our communities. Senator Brown has worked in the past as a member of the Oregon or the Governor's Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault to address issues from a policy standpoint, but this bill to Senator Brown was something that provided a new venue for Oregon to address this problem. Testimony that you will hear today and which will be presented to you in writing indicates that intimate partner violence between men and women in Oregon is a growing problem, and in order to address that, we believe Senate Bill 1047 will provide a venue for open conversations that can provide information in order to better address this growing problem in our communities. You will hear from many of the interest groups involved in this process today, and we will be happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you for your consideration of the bill, and we look forward to its consideration on the Senate floor.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you. Why don't you go ahead and catch your plane? Thank you. Judge Kosh, would you like to go next?
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of this committee. I've met most of you in the past. I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County, and I'm here in that capacity, but I'm also here in a couple of other capacities.
Could you put your name on the record?
I'm Dale Kosh. I apologize. I also serve as the vice president of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, which is a membership organization of 1,700 judicial officers throughout the country who deal with domestic relations, child abuse, and domestic violence cases. I also, in that capacity, serve as the co-chair of the advisory committee of National Judicial Institutes on Domestic Violence. So I come with that background as well as being the presiding judge. And in the role of presiding judge, I sit on the Public Safety Coordinating Council in Multnomah County. So I would just say first that I second the written testimony that was submitted by Judy Shiprack, who is the executive director of our Public Safety Coordinating Council in Multnomah County. I'm just going to be very brief. This bill does not create an entity that is unique in this country. There are many other states that already have this process set up of domestic violence fatality reviews. The aspect of this which is most important to us is to be able to create the confidentiality provision so that we can really have an open and honest dialogue about domestic violence fatalities that occur in our community. Just as some examples of other states that have similar provisions, California, Washington, Nevada are just three examples that are here on the West Coast that have this process set up already. The other part of this bill that I think is key is that this is a permissive bill, that it allows the individual counties to set up this process. It doesn't require any county or any public safety coordinating council that doesn't want to do this or doesn't have the capacity to do this to set up this process, but it does allow those counties that have that capacity and have that desire to do that. I'm hopeful that as some of these processes get set up, that this process really will spread statewide, not by mandate, but rather by observing the results of this process. Though one last thing I would say would be, and I couldn't say it much better than Representative Thatcher said it, we have an obligation as a judicial system to make sure that when victims of domestic violence come before us, that we actually improve the outcomes, the safety outcomes for those victims, rather than inadvertently, in fact, create a more dangerous situation for those victims who are seeking relief from the court. And that's why I'm here in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your work, not only on this bill, but in this issue area overall. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Are there questions for Judge Kosh? Senator Beyer?
Thank you. Is there a prohibition currently that doesn't allow the lipsticks to do this?
There's Madam Chair and Senator Beyer. No, there's not a prohibition that against doing this right now. In fact, we did do one of these in relation to a domestic violence homicide that occurred in our community about 18 months ago. What we discovered in that process, however, is without the provision of confidentiality and without this not taking us out of having the necessity of having a public meeting, that we found that participants in the system that could provide us very valuable information that would assist us in looking at the circumstances of a homicide felt constrained from doing that by those requirements. So that's the reason that we, after having gone through that process once, found that if this would be a much more effective process if we could build in the confidentiality as is built in most states that have this process.
Thank you. And don't you think it'll also be helpful to have the basic framework be the same where these teams are used?
Chair Burdick, yes, I do.
Okay, so you'll be able to compare apples with apples?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Ms. Hebb.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb, for the record, for the Oregon Law Center. You may be wondering why the Law Center, which is a civil legal services provider, has an interest in this bill. And as you are aware, we have tried to prioritize the provision of our services to those low-income people in Oregon who have the greatest need. And the needs of victims of domestic violence have consistently shown up as one of the highest needs that communities have identified. And so we have prioritized those cases, and we have seen an increasing, where we have developed an increasing understanding of the importance of how systems respond to victims, and so have an appreciation for how this bill will help us to make sure that systems are responding appropriately and in the way that's the most effective. I'm also speaking today on behalf of the Legislative Alliance to End Violence Against Women, which is a grassroots network of domestic violence and sexual assault shelters across the state. And we together urge the support of Senate Bill 1047. Just for the record, there is written testimony also from the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence and from Dr. Nancy Glass, who is a doctor at OHSU.
And we will enter that into the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Just briefly, I want to let the committee know that this legislation is modeled very closely on legislation that exists in a number of other states, as Judge Kosh mentioned. It also is similar to legislation that currently exists in Oregon that provides authority for review of child abuse fatalities. And the concept of these fatality review teams is to look at the case and look at the circumstances and see whether the death could have been prevented. The goal is to make sure that systems respond effectively and overall to prevent future deaths. The concept is to bring people together who are charged with the public safety response and help them to assess their response in any particular case to see how they could have done a better job. And the confidentiality provisions allow for that self-assessment to take place in a freer and more full way, leading to more effective and successful, we hope, outcomes and recommendations. The goal of the team is also to help agencies coordinate better between one another and to communicate better after the review is over, so that the system as a whole is working in a more coordinated fashion. The teams are set up such that local groups will come together, and they are multidisciplinary groups that are approved by the LIPSICS, as was referred to. And when those local groups come together, they are able to develop, the bill directs that they develop standardized protocols that are written and agreed to by all of the members of the team so that any review is conducted in a consistent fashion. The bill also provides that those local teams will provide data to a statewide review team, so that the statewide team can maintain statewide statistics and help provide feedback about effective responses in other communities and help share that information on a larger level. Um, We want to make it clear that the bill does mandate specific people to be members of review teams, and those are people who are charged with, or professionals who are charged with specific public safety responses. And it also does allow for the inclusion of any other individual whose expertise or experience might be useful to the team in assessing any individual case. And again, that sort of membership structure is modeled on the structure that exists in other states. We think this bill will help us to do a better job, and we think it will help communities to pull together with the goal of preventing future deaths. So we urge the committee's support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay, next we'll take Terry Canteros. Hope I'm getting better at this. Leanne Medeiros and Connie Gallagher.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Connie Gallagher. I'm the Director of Crime Victims Assistance Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of this bill, in a large part because of my experience as the co-chair of the State Child Fatality Review Team. As the co-chair of that team, I had an opportunity to see the vital importance of these reviews in identifying issues that are relevant to the prevention of abuse fatalities. For example, it was through the child fatality review process that the team was able to recognize a trend regarding an increase in shaken baby syndrome. Through that process, then focused prevention strategies, more specifically the Back to Sleep campaign, was developed in order to help parents become aware of the dangers of putting infants to sleep in a way that might result in certain injuries or death to that child. Also, what I would like to mention is that domestic violence is not a cause of death, but it is, unfortunately, a critical dynamic in Oregon fatalities and critical injuries. It's only through the development of appropriate intervention and prevention efforts that take place through the dialogue that occurs when professionals have an opportunity to meet, have the proper provisions for a confidential dialogue, that we can see any sort of an impact on the reduction of abuse, critical injuries, as well as fatalities. As experience has shown, when professionals meet and this dialogue takes place, what we see is more effective policy development, service prioritization, and better coordinated intervention. This bill does not mandate the reviews, but does make the legal provisions that will encourage these reviews. I encourage your support of this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Terry Quinteros, and I'm here representing Crime Survivors for Community Safety. And we would like to urge the passing of this bill as well. Since 1989, I have worked with literally thousands of domestic and sexual violence survivors in the state of Oregon through shelters and informal networks as well as crisis lines. And I see this bill as hugely important in saving the lives and preventing future deaths caused by domestic violence in the state of Oregon. It has a very broad and inclusive definition in which fatalities may be reviewed. The teams will be multidisciplinary, and as we know in domestic violence, a broad community response is essential if we're going to be effective in responding to violence. The disciplinary team is responsible for issuing recommendations on how to respond and to prevent future domestic violence, which is key in this area. And it also provides for statewide recommendations that are relevant to not only urban areas, but also to rural areas of Oregon as well. As Representative Thatcher mentioned earlier, I believe that this bill will also be a way of honoring and valuing the life of the victim, as well as respecting their privacy and their family's privacy and not allowing them to die in vain. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Other questions? Thank you.
Medeiros. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Leanne Medeiros, and I'm here on behalf of DHS Health Services, and I manage our injury prevention section, the section to collect statewide data on domestic violence. And as part of our many efforts to collect data on this issue, we conducted a review of all the homicides in Oregon. And from studying 7 years of homicide data, we determined that 124 Oregonians were murdered by their intimate partners in that seven-year period, from 1997 to 2003. And we found that nearly half of all female homicides were due to intimate partner violence. 4% of male homicides were killed by an intimate partner. And very sadly, 40% of the victims of the intimate partner homicides had dependent children living with them at the time of the incident. Our section was also responsible for piloting some domestic violence fatality reviews at the request of the Governor's Council on Domestic Violence in 2000. And by piloting those activities in three different sites, we conducted an evaluation and found out that participants in those studies felt the process was very successful in bringing together people from multiple groups to share information, to identify gaps and strengths in the system, and also to generate very practical recommendations that they could use. I also would like to say that 33 other states are currently doing domestic violence fatality review, and as others have mentioned, they've successfully implemented recommendations that we believe are critical in saving lives. So the Department of Human Services recommends your support of Senate Bill 1047, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you all might have. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, and I assume all three of you have had a chance to look at the Dash 1 amendments as well and are concurrent with those. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay. Anybody else want to talk on 1047? I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 1047 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1047.
I'm the chair.
Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 1047.
But we need
I move Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1047.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1047. Is there any discussion? Senator Byrd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No one, I don't, at least I didn't call me, speaking to the issues of the Dash 1s and why, I mean, I understand they clarified, but specifically to the changing from the majority of opinion of these councils to a two-thirds vote, and I'd like to know why.
Ms. Hebb, would you like to come up and address that question? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Byer, members of the committee, Civil Hub for the Oregon Law Center. The amendments were basically contained sort of two parts, and one is an aspect that clarifies some of the confidentiality provisions. And that was, those amendments were drafted after discussions with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and wanting to make sure that those amendments, or that our bill didn't impact currently available discovery methods, and so we specifically indicated that in the bill. The other amendments were drafted sort of to bring the current, our statute, our bill, into sort of a better mirror with some of the legislation in other states. Those amendments were sparked after some comments that were raised by the District Attorneys Association about membership and about decisions about the recommendations that were to be released from individual teams, and the thought was that if there were going to be recommendations made about specific responses that would be more effective, that it ought to be with something larger than a majority, than a simple majority, and that the group should have sort of a larger consensus in making those sorts of recommendations. And so we settled on a two-thirds majority as the appropriate compromise. Other states handle that issue somewhat similarly. There's a spectrum of ways in which they handle how recommendations are released. So,
the bill is patterned after a House bill. Is the original bill the bill that was on the House floor, or is it with the amendments?
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're asking whether the House bill incorporated these amendments. I don't believe it did it?
Chair Burdick, Senator Byer, it did not. The House bill had a hearing, and then before the work session, these amendments were drafted to be a part of the House bill, those exact same amendments, but it did not get to a work session in the House committee. Those exact same amendments are the amendments that are now in front of you today. So the bill itself is a mirror of what the House bill was.
Senator, with the...
Madam Chair, you said, is child defined in this bill?
I'm sorry.
Is child defined in this bill?
Chair Burdick, Senator Whitsitt, I don't believe that the definition of child is specifically mentioned in the bill. I think that we were using a common understanding that was a minor. The bill does
address what sorts
of child deaths would be reviewed by the fatality review team, but it does not specifically define a child.
Follow up, please.
Follow up, Senator
Whitsitt. Chair, that would then exclude a unborn child as a fetus.
I believe that's correct, sir, yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Barton?
Yes, I've been sitting here during the public testimony trying to see exactly what the amendments do and say and what's left in the bill versus the amendments, and I've got a bill here that's reflected in my copy of the highlighted stuff of what's being deleted and what's being changed, and I guess for myself, I would appreciate if you adopt these dash one amendments now to hold the bill and have staff do a hand engrossed copy of it, I guess, so we can see what it actually says and what's left of it.
Senator Barr, I think we had a little bit of a logistical mix-up. We have a hand-engrossed version here that's already been prepared, and council thought it was handed in the packet, but it does not appear to have been. So I think rather than adopt the amendment, because we always forget what we're doing, I think we'll go ahead and distribute the hand engrossed, and we can carry this bill over till tomorrow's meeting, and so people have a chance to take a look at it.
Thank you.
So, Senator Starr, are you comfortable with withdrawing your motion to approve the dash ones?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would.
With unanimous consent, the dash ones are withdrawn, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 1047 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2568. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2568 deals with the Gresham Satellite Courthouse in Multnomah County, and it requires the Circuit Court in Gresham to officially transfer proceedings to a court facility in Portland if the accused is in custody of the county sheriff or the Department of Corrections, or if the accused has an arrest warrant issued for them in a pending criminal action. It also requires an individual to request transfer from that Gresham court to the Portland courthouse at the individual's first appearance. Currently, there's no timeline requirement, and as someone who had the pleasure of staffing the Gresham courthouse when I was with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, I can tell you that what often happens in cases that are out in Gresham is each side gets a certain number of setovers, they take those setovers, and then agree sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge to send it downtown and sort of restart the clock. And as a result, a lot of these cases end up taking longer than the average misdemeanor case does.
Thank you for that summary. And our star witness again is Judge Kosh from Multnomah County. Got two for one today, so maybe the postponement was good. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm Dale Kosh. I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County. Thank you for scheduling both these on the same day. I appreciate that. As Ms. Mollad indicated, this is a bill that we have requested. What's happening right now and it's been the situation for 20-plus years. I can't tell you exactly when the statute was initially put into place, but it requires us in Multnomah County to have all proceedings on any traffic case or any misdemeanor case that occurs east of 122nd Avenue in Multnomah County to be heard in a courthouse located within the city limits of the city of Gresham. That's what it presently provides. As we're going through the process of addressing the court facility in Gresham, and Ms. Moad could talk about the tap dance studio that used to be right above the courtroom, we're looking at a way to clean up the statute at the same time. One of the issues that we were addressing were issues of the neighbors in the locations where we were talking about locating the court facility and their concerns about people in custody appearing in their facilities. Also, in looking at the construction of a new facility there, it saves us saves the county a lot of money in terms of the construction facility if we're billing it as a facility that will not handle in-custody defendants. So although we've never had in-custody defendants in the court facility in Gresham, we need to clean that up because, quite frankly, the statute is written as presently written is open to interpretation on that issue. And the second issue is the one that Ms. Moad addressed, which is these late setovers, issues where people would use the system that appeared to give them the absolute right to control whether the proceeding was in Gresham or downtown. We just want them to, one, make that choice at the first court appearance, and two, if they fail to show up for a court appearance and we have to put a warrant out for them, or if they're in custody, we just want to move those proceedings downtown. The purpose of having a court facility in Gresham is for the convenience of the defendants in these criminal cases, and it's our intent that that's a convenience that they have, but a convenience they can lose if they fail to show up for court. And just to give you an idea of the numbers, this amounts to, we have about 40,000 traffic and misdemeanor cases each year that where the defendant controls the right as to whether that proceeding occurs in the city of Gresham courthouse or not.
Wow. Busy court. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you for coming. Committee, this is pretty straightforward. We're down to only four of us here, so if anybody has any heartburn about this bill, please say so, and if not, we will turn to Senator Starr.
Are we in a work session?
No, we actually are not. We're still in a public hearing. So first of all, we'll close the public hearing and House Bill 2568 and open a work session on House Bill 2568. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2568 is to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2568 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this. Thank you. Now we will move on to our very favorite of all subjects in the world, genetic privacy, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1025.
Madam Chair, it's scheduled for work session because we've had a public hearing.
I'm sorry, I'm not with it today. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 1025, but I want to have a panel up here for us to ask questions of Gwen Dayton, Dave Fedanke, and if Bruce Bishop is here, you're welcome to come up as well. Thank you.
Ted Falk. Ted Falk.
Oh, Ted Falk is here? Okay. Ted, why don't you come on up, too? We should cover the waterfront with this. Okay, Council.
Chair, members of the committee, we have the Dash 3 amendments in front of you, and they basically replace the bill. And I'm sure the panel can give you the details.
Counsel, you're not going to get off that easy, Karen.
it basically expands the ability to use DNA information from the current law, particularly as it relates to coded research versus anonymous research. And it talks about biological samples and genetic information and DNA. It is very, I spent a lot of time reading the amendments, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
I'm sure you did.
I don't know if I still fully understand it, but I do have some questions.
All right, thank you. Let's see, who, Gwen, why don't you go ahead and elaborate on what the dash three amendments do?
Sure, thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm here today in my capacity as co-chair of the Advisory Committee on Genetic Privacy and Research. As we discussed last time, this is a group of the group is comprised of stakeholders on this issue, including providers and consumers, the ASLU and others. We brought to you Senate Bill 1025, and in its original version, this bill provides for a waiver of the consent requirement for coded research. Oregon law currently requires informed consent for coded research. Coded research is research that can only be identified back to an individual through special keys or codes to get back to the identity of the individual. Federal law allows for a waiver of the consent requirement in some limited circumstances. What the Genetic Privacy Advisory Committee sought to do was bring Oregon law in conformance with federal law and allow us to seek a waiver of that consent requirement. Dave Finenke is here from the ACLU, so I will not speak for him except to say that the ACLU expressed some concern about that waiver provision. And in response to that concern, proponents of the bill met with the ACLU and we came up with what are now the Dash 3 amendments. What the Dash 3 amendments do is they continue the opportunity to seek a waiver of consent as the original bill does. So we are implementing or incorporating federal law in state law, allowing researchers to seek a waiver of consent through the Institutional Review Board if certain circumstances are met. But in addition to that, what the Dash 3 amendments do is impose what I would call a notice and opt-out provision. Current Oregon law requires subjects of anonymous research, which means research that simply cannot be identified to an individual under any circumstances. That research can be done if the subject of the provider of the information had the opportunity to opt out from use of his or her information for research. We are extending that opt-out to subjects of coded research as well. So what the Dash 3 amendments do is they require a healthcare provider who is covered by the HIPAA privacy regulations to provide, and that gathers a biological specimen or clinical information from someone, from one of their patients, to provide notice that that specimen or the clinical information, which is basically chart information, medical information, could be disclosed later down the line for research purposes and used for research purposes, and allow the patient to opt out of that use. The typical scenario is this. Community provider sees a patient, does a blood draw, writes things in the chart about whatever's going on with them. That patient is perhaps later seen at a research institute. Their chart follows them. The chart is not disclosed by this community physician specifically for research purposes, but it may be used down the line for that very purpose. What the notice and opt-out provisions in the Dash 3 amendments would do is require that initial provider to let the patient know that their information could be used down the line for research purposes and give them the chance to say, no, I don't want that to happen. If the patient does that, then the information as it's disclosed would have to be tagged as not to be used for research. So down the road, if a research institution like OHSU or perhaps Kaiser has the information, it would be flagged as not to be used, and they couldn't even go through the whole waiver of consent process because that information would be taken out of the stream. If the patient themselves doesn't make the choice to take their information out of the stream, then the researcher can go through the waiver of consent processes that are in the bill and that are also in federal law.
Okay, so what this means then is that patients who, for example, gave information before HIPAA, before the genetic privacy, they never had a chance to give consent because it wasn't
relevant at the time, their data, maybe from 10 years ago, could still be used? And if someone had passed away, their data could be used?
Yes, I invite correction if I'm incorrect on this point, but that's my understanding, is that if their information was gathered some time ago before the implementation of HIPAA, that information could, because there's no opportunity to provide this notice and opt out, that information could still be in the stream.
But somebody who has signed an opt out under the anonymous research provision earlier, before this bill, their research, their information still could not be used. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, that is correct unless it's already grandfathered in. I think it's prior to 2001 that information is grandfathered in. The other point that you raised that I should have raised affirmatively myself is the amendments also contain a provision allowing information obtained from a deceased person who's not able to give the opt-out could be used without the opt-out.
Okay. Dave, why don't you introduce yourself? That's a good segue here.
Thank you. David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon, also speaking in support of the Dash 3 amendments. I'd like to start by backing up a little bit. The current law, which required the opportunity to opt out for anonymous research, had never been adequately implemented. Because that requirement only kicked in at the point that a decision was made to want to use either a biological specimen or a clinical record for genetic research, only then did it come under the provisions of the current law. And because there was no process in place that systematically provided the notice and the opportunity to opt out for anonymous research to individuals, to patients, that provision really had no practical effect. These Dash 3 amendments will both put teeth in that provision, and in return for that, we are willing to allow coded samples to be used for coded research that also are obtained from people who have received this notice and not chosen to opt out, and have not chosen to opt out of genetic research. From our perspective, that is a very important change to the law, and it would be a change for the better. The way that the notice and opt-out are intended to be implemented will provide a lot of flexibility to healthcare providers. Since the passage of the last major revision of this law in 2001, healthcare providers have implemented the HIPAA notices required under federal law. And we're specifically providing in these Dash 3 amendments that the rules to be adopted by the Health Division, which would have to be adopted by January 1, these particular provisions wouldn't become operative until July 1 of 2006. So there'd be 6 months as an implementation time period. The Dash 3 amendments will allow health care providers to choose whether they want to provide this notice as part of the HIPAA notice or separately. As we were all sitting around the table talking about how this could be implemented, we realized that healthcare providers don't have a recurring obligation to provide the HIPAA notification unless something changes either in their privacy practices or in federal law. So for many patients, majority of patients, they've already received a HIPAA notice. Healthcare providers may decide they want to just do a separate standalone notification regarding genetic research, which will be permitted under this bill. But if they decide they want to fold it into the HIPAA notice, they can do that as well. There's also flexibility in terms of how the opt-out provision could be tracked. It will have to be tracked if someone chooses to opt out. But our intention is to provide flexibility for different providers to decide how they want to do that, pursuant to the rules that will be adopted by the Health Division. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you. I'm starting to get alarmed because I'm actually understanding this.
We tried to make it simple. You might not have succeeded, but we tried to make it simple.
Thank you. Mr. Bishop, did you want to add? Thank you, Dave. Before we move on, does anybody have any questions of Dave or Gwen? Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems in support of the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1025. And I won't go into much detail because if the chair understands the amendments, I'm satisfied that anything I would say would confuse matters further. I would like to indicate generally, however, that we believe the Dash 3 amendments are a step forward. There is going to be no perfect solution in this area because science and the law continue to change, but we think that these amendments are an appropriate balance of privacy and clinical research interests and allow those kinds of activities to proceed in Oregon in the future. We would support the Dash 3 amendments. We would wish that you would not have to deal with this ever again. I can't assure you that that will be the case, but we think this is a positive step forward and urge adoption of the Dash 3 amendments.
Thank you very much. Do you have any sense of, and again, as Mr. Fidanke pointed out, the provision for opting out was not implemented in the way more assertively in the way it will be here. But do you have any sense of how many people are opting out and whether this is going to be a widely used mechanism? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't have any empirical data about that. I would hypothesize that it's a relatively small number of people who actually will exercise the opt-out, but I think it's an important protection for those people who desire to do that, to be able to do so. But I can't quantify what extent it would be exercised.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, I think the biggest problem with the current system is that the notice hasn't been given mm-hmm. by very many providers. Because at the time a patient comes in, no decision has been made to use their biological specimen or clinical information for genetic research. And what these amendments will do is require that the notification be made at the front end before that decision has been made, so that when a researcher later decides that it's important to have access to that biological specimen or clinical chart or other clinical information, that notification will have been given. And if the person chose to opt out, there will be a record of that. And if not, then it can be assumed the sample can be used for anonymous accredited research.
The reason I asked the question, of course, and we do have people in the back from OHSU, and they may get dragged forward, so you're on notice, is, you know, in order to have accurate research, you have to be able to cover a wide population of people. And if you have people with certain diseases, you know, for example, HIV, selecting themselves out, then that you could see where that would interfere with the research, with the quality of the research.
Yeah, it's certainly our assumption that relatively few people will opt out, but we also know that there is, from the public opinion research that's been done here in Oregon and elsewhere, there's a great deal of concern among members of the public about genetic research and about how their samples may be used and tracked. So we hope that part of the beneficial aspect of this will be to educate people about not only what can be done with their biological specimens and other information, but the safeguards that will be put in place to keep that private.
Well, I think a lot of people would find a lot of security just that they had control.
And exactly.
It's one thing to let something go. It's another thing to have it taken without your consent.
Yeah. And exactly.
Okay.
Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Dayton, I've got a couple of questions for you, Madam Chair, if you don't mind asking two in a row.
Please, just don't confuse me. That's all.
Section 5 of the bill, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Section 2, it says a health care provider that is not a covered entity. And the Section 1, it says a health care provider that is a covered entity. Covered entity is defined in OS 192.519. Ms. Dayton, could you give me an example of what is not a covered entity?
Chair Burke, members of the committee, again for the record, I'm Gwen Dayton, co-chair of the Genetic Privacy Advisory Committee. HIPAA defines a covered entity as either a healthcare provider that transmits information in electronic form, a health insurer, or a healthcare clearinghouse. For our purposes today, we're really talking about healthcare providers. Entity that holds a biological specimen or clinical information that would not be covered by HIPAA would be a healthcare provider that for some reason does not transmit information electronically. Typically, and when they, you're welcome to the land of HIPAA lingo, transmit information electronically typically talks about billing electronically. If you are a very small provider, such as a naturopath, maybe somebody who has an entirely paper practice, you would be deemed a healthcare provider, but not a healthcare provider that is covered by HIPAA. So when we talk about a healthcare provider that is covered by HIPAA must do this, whereas a provider that is not covered by HIPAA may do this, we are trying to pull out those typically quite small providers that don't have an electronic medical practice at all. Not to say that they can't give the notice. They certainly can, but they're not required to.
Thank you, Ms. Dayton. One further question, Madam Chair.
Before you ask that question, so in those cases, because they are not required to give to notify the individual, then would those specimens from those people be open to research?
Chair Burdick, my interpretation of that is they would not be, because the person, the patient, the subject of the information did not have the opportunity to opt out. And it's that opportunity to opt out that is the requirement in this bill that allows the research to proceed.
But if they did use their discretion to notify and then the person didn't opt out, then that could be used.
Chair Burdick, yes.
Okay. Chair Burdick, again, David Fidenke. My understanding is that we're talking about less than 5% of all healthcare providers that are not covered entities under HIPAA. Understanding I think we had around the table was that those folks are not currently relied on for providing samples for genetic research. It tends to be the larger providers that are. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that if a healthcare provider who's not a covered entity sends someone to a clinical lab to provide a biological specimen, my understanding is that under these amendments, the clinical lab would also be required to provide a HIPAA notice if they are a covered entity, correct?
CLIA labs aren't covered entities, I don't think. I don't know that CLIA labs are covered by HIPAA.
Ah, they may not be.
We'll work on that.
Would you answer that on the record?
Yeah, could you share that for us?
<I'm buttering.
laughs> Double secret handshake.
Grant. Ms. Dayton is correcting my assumption. Go ahead.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, the example given was that if a non-covered provider refers a person to a clinical lab for the obtaining of a biological specimen, that lab would be required then to give the notice because they are a HIPAA-covered entity. I am not entirely certain that CLIA labs are covered by HIPAA. That's an area that we'll need to clarify. And we're glad to do that for the committee. And we can either clarify it now or we can clarify it if it is moved to the House.
So labs aren't covered by HIPAA?
Now we're getting, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, now we're getting literally into an area that I have to look it up. Recollection is that CLIA labs, which are a very distinct kind of lab, are not under the jurisdiction of the HIPAA privacy regulations, but I would need to. I haven't thought about that probably in 6 months. I'd have to clarify that for the committee. I'm glad to do that.
But basically, even whether they are or aren't covered, if the person hasn't had the opportunity to opt out, then the sample can't be used. Is
yes.
that correct? Okay. All right. We're on the same page here. You okay with that, Dave?
Yes.
Okay. All right. We've got one more person to hear from.
Oh, you had one more question. I'm sorry. Let's wait for the other question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Dayton, again, I'm directing your attention to page 9 of the bill in bold language, starting actually in page, into page 8. A health care provider described in this section shall provide notice to an individual describing how biological specimen or clinical individual identifiable health care information may be used and allowing the individual to request the specimen or information not be disclosed or retained for anonymous research or coded research. Ms. Dayton, I assume that because they have to request, if the individual says no, it can't be used, it cannot be used.
Chair Berg, members of the committee, Mr. Taylor, yes, and referring you back to Section 3 of the bill on page 5, amendments to ORS 192-537 make it clear, I'm looking at subsection 2A, big C, that you can only do use somebody's DNA sample or genetic information for anonymous or coded research if the individual was notified and did not opt out.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is that it?
That's it.
Okay. Mr. Fox, you've been very patient.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ted Falk, and I was here today as a private citizen. I am a member of the advisory committee. Since I think these amendments have already been pretty well explained, I'll just add a couple of points. Globally, what we're dealing here, what we have here is a compromise between the needs of the community to promote research and the privacy of the individual. The gain of the community here is to have low risk, from this ethical standpoint, low risk genetic research proceed. So we get more genetic research done. The gain to the individual is greater awareness of their rights as an individual to opt in or opt out of research. And this notice and opt out would be more effective than previous educational mechanisms that have existed. So once we get below that level, it quickly becomes a matter of a rather technical piece of legislation, and as you can tell from the data on these Dash 3 amendments, the discussions of it went right up to the wire. I expect there will be some very minor wording smoothing out that may occur in the House, and so it may come back to you for conforming, but I think that we have here a pretty good compromise, which is very consistent with the prior work of the advisory committee in the sense that they're trying to strike at this balance between individual rights and the community needs, particularly those of the research community.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? I want to commend the folks who worked on this. I think we got some good ground made in privacy and good ground made in assuring that we can have the kind of research we need. I'm going to excuse this panel. I just want to bring up the OHSU folks just very briefly just to get it on the record that this is going to be a good thing for OHSU's research. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Gary Chiodo from Oregon Health and Science University. I'm the director of the OHSU Research Integrity Office. I have reviewed the revised rule, and this will truly advance the ability to do genetic research, while I feel also adding an increment of protection for those who whose genetic information may be used. The two parts that are particularly important are the extension, if you will, of the opt-out provision for coded as well as anonymous research, and not to be overlooked, the revision of the portion that deals with information from decedents. Current iteration of the law simply does not allow research with information from decedents, which I think may have been an unintended consequence of how the wording came out. But the suggested revision will allow that.
I appreciate that, and I guess the bottom line is, if this is in effect, can we look forward to an invention of the next Gleevec?
Ch- Chair Burdick. I am happy to let you know that Dr. Drucker is working on an extension of the use of Gleevec for several other types of tumors that have the same genetic expression in that tumor itself. So there are actually probably three or four other types of cancers that are genetically related to the type of leukemia that Gleevec was originally intended for, and it may in fact prove to be useful there. So Dr. Drucker is hard at work.
That's good. I'm glad to hear it, and thank you for sharing that with us. Other questions of OHSU, Dr. Chiodo? Thank you very much. Okay, we are in work session, and we have this work product that is many weeks in the making and I think is a really good balancing. Senator Starr, we have the dash three amendments in front of us.
Madam Chair, I move dash three amendments to Senate Bill 1025.
Senator Starr moves the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 1025. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1025 as amended to the floor to the pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves 1025. Senate Bill 1025 is amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this bill, for better or worse. Thank you, and thanks again for all who worked on this. Okay, now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 392. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 392 comes to you from Senator Westland, and mainly what this does, Madam Chair, members of the committee, you may remember the testimony from the last time, prohibits a slayer from inheriting from the heir or devisee of the slain person. When you heard testimony concerning the fact that in Bend a woman murdered her husband, they have one child, a minor child who's underage, and I guess because no one thought of it at the time when this law was put into effect, if that minor were to die, the mother would inherit all of the husband's property that has gone to the child. And as you know, the statute is originally written, basically states, and it's in every state has this, that if you slay someone, you can't inherit from them.
That seems fair, counsel. This was brought to us by Senator Westland, who did a very impassioned and articulate presentation of the problem. And I don't see any amendments here on this bill. So, Senator Starr, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 392 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 392 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Anybody like to carry this?
Senator Westland.
Oh, let's have Senator Westland carry this. That's a good idea. Okay, that means you're in charge of telling Senator Westland he's carrying this to council. Okay, thank you. Now we'll open a work session on House Bill 2634. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2634 comes to you from the Oregon Association of Realtors. I was originally heard in this committee on May 24th. This bill establishes pleading requirements for professional negligence actions against real estate licensees. It requires that a claimant's attorney to consult the qualified real estate licensee who will testify to admissible facts and opinions sufficient to create a question of fact as to the liability of the licensee who the claimant is suing. We heard testimony really from Representative Ackerman that in these types of cases, professional is generally required to testify. This puts that requirement on the front end of the litigation in an effort to save litigation costs, I guess, for the licensees who, and I guess, stop some frivolous claims from being brought.
Okay. We have no amendments, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I think this is a pretty straightforward bill. Senator Starr, do you have a motion?
Move House Bill 2634 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2634 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Whitsitt, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
All right, now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2305. Council.
Committee, House Bill 2305 comes to you from the Oregon Collectors Association. This bill allows the sole proprietor of a business to designate an individual to accept service or writ of garnishment, and also permits office delivery to partnerships. In some instances, it may be difficult for creditors or the people who are delivering a writ of garnishment to determine whether a business is a sole proprietorship or a partnership. This may lead to improper delivery of the writ. This bill makes delivery standards uniform for sole proprietorships and partnerships by permitting a sole proprietor to designate an individual to accept service of a writ of garnishment and permitting office delivery for partnerships. This bill passed the House unanimously on the consent calendar.
Thank you. And we have signed up Jim Marquis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. Learned counsel has explained the bill. It is pretty straightforward. The Oregon Law Commission rewrote the law in this area a couple of years ago. I served on that work group, and one of the problems that came about from that rewrite was that the way in which a writ of garnishment is delivered to a sole proprietorship or a partnership were treated differently depending upon which you were delivering the writ to. And sometimes the process server can't tell if it's a sole proprietorship or a partnership, so this just creates uniformity and so that they're done the same regardless of whether it's a sole proprietorship or a partnership. Be happy to answer any. There's nobody in the building that we're aware of that opposes the bill, and it did pass the House unanimously. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Marquis? Thank you very much. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2305 and open a work session on House Bill 2305. Senator Starr.
Yes, Madam Chair. Move House Bill 2305A to the Senate floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2305 to the Senate floor with due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Let's see, who'd like to carry this? Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
You'd be thrilled, right? Okay. Last bill. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2306. Mr. Marquis.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2306 also comes to you from the Oregon Collectors Association. This bill makes unmarried parents liable for the expenses of their children, and it makes unmarried parents and husbands and wives liable for the expenses of their minor children, even if those children are deemed to have attained majority because those children have become parents. It also clarifies that neither unmarried parents nor spouses are liable for the expenses of grandchildren, and it requires that paternity previously must be established for parental liability to apply. Basically, House Bill 2306 applies the standards that determine liability for expenses of children of married parents to unmarried parents as well. And it provides that unmarried parents who live together are liable for the expenses and education of their children.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Marquis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. I've submitted written testimony, and attached to that are copies of the relevant statutes which are referred to in this bill for your reference in looking at the bill. Under current law, ORS 108040 makes spouses equally responsible for the debts of that are incurred for the benefit of the family or for expenses of the children or education of the children. And this is a long-standing law that has it's been on the books many, many years, and there's a lot of case law about it as to what would constitute a family expense. And under this family expense law, it doesn't matter which spouse incurs the debt on behalf of, for the benefit of the children or for the benefit of the family. That is to say that if the child is sick or in need of an operation or there's some emergency and the parent, one of the parents or one of the spouses, because they have to be married under this law, takes the child to the hospital and signs him in, and the work is performed, both parents are equally responsible for that debt. It doesn't matter which parent signed the child in or signed the papers at the hospital, and this has been a long-standing law. No such law applies to parents of children that live together without benefit of a legal document, marriage, a legal marriage document. And so this bill, in this bill, we are attempting to extend that responsibility to unmarried parents for the expenses of their children. Now, in doing so, there was a lot of discussion about this, and I said under 108.040, the Family Expense Law, spouses are responsible for the debts of the family and for the debts incurred for the benefit of the children. Family expenses don't necessarily have to be for the benefit of the children, obviously, and there's a kind of an interesting case I read, an old case about whether or not a horse and buggy was a family expense under this statute, and it was ruled that it was. So, you know, and it could be cars or it could be those kind of things. We decided that as we drafted this legislation, that as a matter of policy, we would not try to extend to unmarried people equal liability for family expenses that were not related to or for the benefit of the children. So in other words, this new statute would track the family expense statute only as to those expenses incurred for the benefit of the children, and for the benefit of the children while the two folks are living together. Now, under the Family Expense Statute 108.040, spouses who separate remain responsible for debts incurred for the maintenance, support, or education of the children, which is slightly narrower than expenses of the child. In other words, we're separated, and there's a whole section in here in the present statute and in the new statute about what constitutes separation and what the court would consider separation or consider in deciding if there was separation. But upon separation, the responsibility of the non-custodial parent is somewhat narrower, or the parent who didn't incur the debt, in that they would only be responsible if it was what I would like to say a required debt, a debt that's required for the support, maintenance, or education of the child. Non-custodial parent would not be obligated to pay for a Maserati that somebody bought a 16-year-old. I think the court would say you don't have to pay for that. You didn't do it. So that's what the bill does. It's merely because, as you know, in our society, a lot of folks choose to live together and to have children together, and there is no legal marriage document, and we think that they ought to be just as responsible for their children and for debts incurred on behalf or for the benefit of those children as people who live together who are married. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
My daughter started receiving credit card applications at, I think, age 9.
Yeah.
What happens to debts that the child incurs?
Good question. Under Oregon law, debts incurred by a minor child are usually not enforceable, although please keep in mind I'm not a lawyer of any sort, particularly a collection lawyer, but usually those are not enforceable. Now, and we tried to speak a little bit to that issue in this bill, and I'm a little bit remiss in that I didn't cover this in my original testimony, but it is in my written testimony. There's an interesting statute, 109.112, that's on the books that says when you have a child, you are no longer a minor. Now, and then it goes on to say that you shall be deemed to have attained a majority and, regardless of age, may give authorizations, releases, waivers, etc., for the child. And I think that, although I haven't checked the archives fully, I believe that that statute was probably enacted so that people who had children who would otherwise be minors, that is, under the age of 18, could sign papers to take care of medical needs for their baby. But it's been interpreted by the courts to be broader than that. And so if a 16-year-old girl has a baby and her parents are being supportive of her and say, and her, it's her choice to have the baby, and they're supportive and say, continue to live with us, we're going to help you and take care of you, and you can live with us with your baby. Under this 109.112, the courts have ruled that as soon as she has the baby, her parents are no longer responsible financially for any debt that she might incur, even if it is for the benefit of her. So we have said in this bill that those parents would still be responsible for their 16-year-old, in other words, for debts incurred for the benefit of the 16-year-old. But what we specifically did not extend that liability to were debts for the benefit of the grandchild of the parents or the 16-year-old's baby.
Oh, I see. So you deviated from the existing law and said even if someone has a child, the parent, an unmarried parent, is still responsible for their own the debts of their own child,
right,
not the grandchild.
Right.
What about the in that scenario? What if it's their son who has a child under existing law?
Same thing would apply.
Don't you think it should be consistent?
It is consistent. The same thing would apply. That's what I'm saying.
No, what I'm saying is that's consistent. But don't you think that the responsibility for the child who has a child should be consistent with existing law?
It is.
Well, maybe I misunderstood then. I thought you said that under the bill that unmarried parents would still be responsible for the debts of their child,
yes,
but not the grandchild.
Yeah, and,
but the
and
way
that
I
was,
understood
oh, I
existing
what you're saying.
Law is yeah. They aren't responsible for the debts of the child.
Right. Under existing law, neither married parents nor unmarried parents are responsible for the debts of their children after if their child has a baby because of 109.112. 109.112 says that as soon as you have a baby,
right, but your
daughter or father, you're no longer a minor, and we're simply saying you continue to your parents continue to be responsible for you until you're 18.
And whether you're married or unmarried.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
Well, that's a fairly major change. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Pozanski.
Chairman, that last part. If a minor is emancipated under this bill, are the parents still going to be obligated until age 18?
No. Madam Chair, Representative Pozanski, Senator Pozanski, excuse me. No, it is only operative. The only change is relative to 109.112. This bill in no way amends the emancipation statutes, nor does it say that parents must be responsible for their children until they're 18, irregardless. It only says that 109.112, which says that once you have a child, you are automatically deemed to reach the age of majority. If the reason that you have become of majority is solely because you had a child, then the family expense statute is still operative as to that child. And that's what it says. So we're not saying, no. So we're still allowing people to be emancipated if that's their choice.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions, Senator Barr?
Yeah. No, I thought I heard you say that if a 16-year-old boy or girl has a child, they are still, the 16-year-old is still, or the debts of the 16-year-old is still responsibility of the parent of the 16-year-old. What if that child is married?
Good question, Senator Barr.
If, actually, if the child is married, there's another operative statute that would preclude them from being the parents under 108.040 from being responsible for them, and I can't cite that because it's not reiterated in the bill. But it is. But they, the once the teenage children or teenage children get married, their parents are no longer responsible for them because you in this state you reach the you become of majority if you are married.
That's a form of emancipation.
It is a form of emancipation.
Senator, did you have another question? Senator Whitson.
Does this, Chair Burdick, Mr. Marquis, does this require that the unmarried 16-year-old parent live with their unmarried parents or unmarried parent? Or if that 16-year-old, in fact, has a child, moves out, begins charging things on their own, the parent is the original parent, unmarried parent, is still liable for their expenses?
Only as to the debts incurred for the benefit of the 16-year-old, not debts incurred for the benefit of the baby if they had one. Or for other people.
I know where you're going, Senator Whitson.
So you have a young lady that gets pregnant, runs away, has a child, and she continues to charge things, and that parent, the, her unmarried parent, is going to be liable for all of her charges until she's 18 years of age.
Just the same, Madam Chair, Senator Whitson, just the same as if a... if that occurred under present law for married parents, yes.
I don't think so.
In other words, if a child ran away from home and incurred substantial debt, the parents would be responsible for that debt under current law under 108.040.
Oh, you said the opposite. Counsel, did you have insight on this?
If I heard that correctly, I think Senator Whitsett was asking if that child ran away and had a child himself. Is that correct? That's the scenario he was talking about. Mm-hmm. And so the question there was, would the parents be liable for, or what would the scope of the liability be, I think was the question.
But you said earlier that under existing law that this bill would change, the parents are no longer liable for the child once the child has a baby. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct. Okay. Yeah, that is correct.
That's what I was saying.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay.
Yeah. Then if the married parents of a child would no longer be responsible for that child after that child had a baby, but in this scenario... If the unmarried parents of a child, in that situation, if that child had a baby, they would still be responsible for the expenses of that child.
Actually, Madam Chair, Senator Whitson, I believe I misunderstood your question the first time around here. Let me try to explain that, okay. If I can.
Under current law,
married parents are responsible equally for the debts of their children unless one of their children has a baby. And then they are no longer responsible for the debts incurred for that child who had the baby because that child is no longer a minor. Under present law, additionally, unmarried parents are not equally responsible for the debts incurred for the benefit of their children, regardless.
If I can break in here, I think what Senator Whitsitt was getting at, the bill would change the requirements not only for unmarried parents, but for married parents.
Yes.
Married parents with this bill would become responsible for their children even when the children had a baby. So that would be a
yes.
change to existing
law. Yes, it would, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I need to be off somewhere. So are there other questions? Because I'm going to close this hearing. Close the hearing on House Bill 2306 and adjourn Senate Judiciary. Thank you.